Devil's Wood, written by Mark McNeese, produced by Mademark Publishing, narration provided by Wondervox. Chapter 1, Sticks and Stones. At first, Matthew thought it was just another broken branch, more of nature's debris. The woods were full of it this time of year, when spring revealed its regeneration and the leftovers of winter littered the ground. Storm-fallen limbs, snapped saplings, half-rotted trunks shedding pieces of themselves onto the damp earth. He and his best friend Micah had been combing the forest the way they often did, moving slowly along paths covered in dead leaves, eyes trained on the ground rather than the trees. They were searching for arrowheads, or something old enough to seem significant. The kinds of things that fueled his imagination, conjuring lost worlds and forgotten languages. Most of what they found was useless, except maybe to the animals and insects that lived there. A jagged stone with bugs beneath it, a bit of rusted metal sheltering a worm, a shard of something that might once have been a glass container. Still, Matthew liked believing he would find pieces of a stone knife this time, used centuries ago for hunting or warfare, or fragments of ancient pottery. Belief came easily to him. A rock with what looked like a carving etched in it could become a talisman cherished by a revered shaman. A bent nail could be a sliver of pioneer history. His imagination filled in the gaps where the real world disappointed him, and he didn't mind that at all. Reality was noisy and sharp-edged and full of modern dangers. There were no fathers who drank too much back then, although he had no way to verify that. Earlier civilizations knew about fermentation too, but were there alcoholics among the tribes? There were certainly no mothers swallowing antidepressants like vitamins just to make it through the day. No older brother who treated you like something stuck to the bottom of his shoe. No younger sister who demanded attention and received it to a degree he'd never known. In the woods, Matthew could pretend none of that existed. "What's that?" Micah said. He was standing several feet away, tall and awkward, his dirty white baseball cap turned backward the way it always was. At 12, Micah was already shooting up fast, all elbows and knees, his body not quite keeping pace with itself. His New Jersey Devil's sweatshirt hung loose on him, a hand-me-down from his cousin Lenny. Micah didn't care about hockey, but clothes were clothes, and you wore whatever showed up in the bag Aunt Trish dropped off now and then. "I thought it was a branch," Matthew said. That was not what it looked like up close. He crouched, then knelt, the dampness from the morning rain seeping straight through his jeans. The stick lay half buried beneath leaves and soil, too straight in some places, too deliberately curved in others. He wrapped his fingers around it and felt a faint resistance as he pulled it free, as if the ground didn't want to let go. It was nearly as tall as he was. "This is amazing," Matthew said, turning it in his hands. Micah stepped further away, refusing to come any closer. The upper portion of the stick twisted in on itself, curled in a way Matthew had never seen in a natural branch. It looked more like something shaped on a lathe. Two shades of brown spiraled together along its length, tight and intentional, and running through the curve was a thin vein of gold, dull rather than bright, faded from its time in the dirt. "Let's go," Micah said. "But look at it." "It's just some old hiker's walking stick," Micah said. His voice was tight. "Someone forgot it. Let's get out of here."
"I'm taking it home."
"Leave it," Micah said. The tone of his voice made Matthew look up. "What's wrong with you?"
"It's getting late."
Matthew glanced at the sky. The clouds had thickened, low and gray, pressing down on the treetops. He knew Micah was right, even if he didn't care much himself. No one would notice if he was late getting home. They'd stopped eating together long ago, trading family dinners for TV trays and microwaved meals. Micah's parents, on the other hand, would already be checking the clock. "You're such a pussy," Matthew said, the familiar insult landing without real heat. "Bring it home then," Micah said, backing away. "Just hurry up." Matthew brushed dirt and leaves from the stick, running his thumb along the twisted grain. That was when he saw it, something pale beneath the dark soil. Not a flash, not a shine, just wrongness, a whiteness that didn't belong there. He froze. He'd seen this before. Not here,
not like this, but enough times to recognize it. Matthew was a forager. He knew what bones looked like when the earth tried to hide them.
"It's just a dead animal," Micah said.
He didn't turn around.
"Leave it alone."
Matthew didn't answer. He knelt again and brushed away the dirt, slowly at first, then faster as the shape grew larger, smoother, unmistakable. It wasn't a shard or a polished rock. It was a skull.
"Jesus,"
Matthew whispered, his fingers working faster. Soon there was enough of it exposed to reveal the facial bones of a dead human being, eye sockets, teeth, and a hole in the forehead. Whoever was buried there had not died peacefully. He turned to tell Micah what he'd found, but Micah was already gone, hurrying toward the road 100 yards off.
"It's just a stick," Matthew shouted after him. "Just a stick! Just a skull! Just a bullet hole!"
As he stared down at what the ground had been concealing, Matthew knew there was much more to what he'd found. And someday he would understand that this was the moment he should have run, too. Chapter 2. 6 months earlier. Peter Brightley loved Lambertville, New Jersey, despite everything that had gone wrong there. It wasn't the town's fault that Susan had decided to divorce him and move to Doylestown, Pennsylvania, 20 minutes and a world away from the life they'd shared. She took their 14-year-old twin sons, Lucas and Jonathan, with her, upending their lives with the same cool efficiency she displayed when she sold things on Facebook Marketplace. One listing at a time. Photographed, described, priced, gone. 20 years with Peter had seemed no different, at least to him. It was as if she'd offered their memories to the lowest bidder, and no one had bought them. Once they'd sorted through what each of them wanted, with some of the leftovers put on the front porch beneath a handwritten free stuff sign, the break was complete. The change, irreversible. As an antique dealer and longtime small businessman, Peter understood the impulse to sell. He just hadn't expected his life to be discounted so steeply. The divorce itself had been relatively amicable. They'd shouted their way through 6 months of accusations and recriminations before lawyers entered the picture, and by the time signatures were required, there was little venom left. Susan didn't hate him. He didn't hate her. They had simply grown too far apart to meet in the middle. Not irreparably different, just different enough to make staying together dishonest. Neither of them wanted their boys growing up in a house like that, so they'd finally cut the cord and stopped the bleeding. Most of it, anyway. She'd kept her name when they married, Susan Farrow, as if she'd anticipated this very outcome, or at least its possibility. She'd been a freelance graphic designer for most of their marriage, a job that made their move from Newark relatively easy, since there was no office requiring her presence. Their sons had his last name, which provided a small measure of comfort. Lucas had been named after Peter's father, with Jonathan taking Susan's grandfather's name. Peter had refused to shorten them, finding Luke and John too biblical sounding. They stayed with Peter every other weekend in his condo on Union Street. He'd made sure to buy a two-bedroom after the house was sold and the proceeds split. This gave the boys a room of their own, with bunk beds they were quickly outgrowing. They would be young men soon enough, and Peter wasn't in a hurry to reach that milestone. The biggest blow wasn't the divorce. It was how quickly Susan had replaced him. Andrew Dowling, of Dowling Sporting Goods. A modest but successful chain stretching from Doylestown to Philadelphia. 6 stores in all, the last time Peter checked. Researching the man didn't qualify as stalking, no matter how it might seem. Peter had never followed him, driving discreetly 3 cars behind. He didn't know where Andrew lived, and had only seen him in photographs and on the company website. Okay, and on his son's phones too, even though they were reluctant to show him pictures. They were kids. They liked the adventures Andrew took them on, day trips and short vacations Peter had never had the time for until it was too late. Facts lingered, truths hurt. Andrew was handsome and 5 years younger than Susan. Peter sometimes imagined telling her she'd be traded in for a newer model eventually, but the subject of her new relationship was off limits in all but the most casual ways. Even the boys knew better than to say too much, though things slipped out. Andrew was taking them to a Phillies game. Andrew bought them Stockley Stormrider 95 skis, Andrew was flying them to Aspen in December. Each revelation was followed by an immediate silence, as if they could rewind time and take it back. Maybe it was the pain Peter failed to hide when they told him these things, or maybe it was the anger. Curious Collectibles had survived 12 years in a business that wore people out like dish rags used too long. Lambertville had been a thriving antique center since the 1980s, anticipating the town's revival after several rough decades. There were 8 shops when Peter and Susan opened their doors, including Whispered Treasures, run by the dreadful Patsy Lolly. She'd been in the storefront next to them when they moved in, and Peter and Patsy had loathed each other ever since. He always called her Patricia when they interacted, which was as seldom as possible. He knew she didn't like it. He'd watched other businesses come and go, victims of bad timing, poor judgment, or simple hard luck. Restaurants, coffee shops, antique stores. The odds were never good. The trick was accepting the likelihood of failure and giving it your best shot anyway. He was on his way to an estate sale in Pennsylvania this morning. He glanced at himself in the rearview mirror as he approached the property. 42 wasn't bad. He still had his hair, full, if graying at the temples. He ran a hand over it, checking the firmness of the gel. Solid, wavy, presentable. He might not be Andrew Dowling, but he was a damn good Peter Brightley. He wore brown corduroys and a yellow button-down tucked into a belt he'd only let out one notch in 10 years. Not bad, he thought. I wouldn't kick me out of bed. If I were gay, which I'm not. But maybe it's something to consider. The GPS had guided him across the river from Frenchtown, then along the Pennsylvania side past Upper Black Eddy. He didn't know the area well, but he trusted the map lady, as he called the synthetic voice. When she told you to turn, you turned. Susan had never shared that faith. She always knew a better route and almost always got them lost. He wasn't lost now, just unsure where he was. He'd received a postcard at home inviting him to the auction. It included the date, time, address, and the words, "A special sale from a special estate," in italics. He hadn't wondered what might be so special about it until now. For one thing, the house seemed deliberately hidden from view. It sat at the end of a long driveway, flanked by overgrown grass and a scattering of trees that offered little comfort and no shade. It wasn't needed in October, but he imagined summers were hot here, hot and sticky and mosquito-filled. Winters would be harsh when they came, the cold kept out by a fireplace, its dark brick chimney rising to the sky. He glanced up at it, imagining smoke rising from the top. A dozen cars were already parked on the gravel drive. The colonial structure itself looked stranded, as if it had been lifted from a Virginia farm and dropped into rural Pennsylvania without explanation. The wraparound porch sagged slightly, its pillars worn, paint peeled. Moss and lichen crept along the exterior walls, claiming territory no one had bothered to defend. Aside from the other cars, there was no sign of life. Completely alone, Peter thought, then dismissed the comparison between the house and himself before it could settle in. He parked beside a Subaru Forester and stepped out. The front door stood open, activity visible inside. Estate sales were essential to the antique trade. Liquidations of lives condensed into furniture, jewelry, photographs, and objects whose owners were usually dead. This one felt especially final. It looked as if no one had lived here for a long time. "Welcome," a man said at the door. "You are?" "Peter Brightley, Curious Collectibles." "Lambertville." "Yes, we spoke on the phone. Derek Rollins." Peter recognized the voice and the name. The postcard had come from him, his name on the return address with a phone number below it. Derek was polite, slightly stiff in person. He'd answered when Peter called earlier that week. Red Oak Auction Services in Princeton, an outfit he was unfamiliar with. He'd wanted more information about the sale, to see if it was a match for what he offered at the store. Derek had claimed to be in the middle of something and promised to call Peter back. He never did. Now that Peter was here, the man offered no explanation for the oversight, just his smile, as practiced and precise as his choice of a navy suit and yellow tie. Derek Rollins was a package deal, the kind of man who memorized details about you and repeated them back to make you feel known. except when he wasn't returning your calls. Good morning, Derek, Peter said. Looks like I'm barely on time. 10 minutes yet. Did you bring the postcard? It's your invitation. Peter cocked his head. I didn't realize this was invitation only. That's what makes it special, Derek replied, echoing the words on the card. Peter handed it over. Derek glanced at it and handed it back. You can register with Rebecca and get your paddle. Peter folded the card and put it in his shirt pocket. Inside, the foyer stopped Peter cold. This had once been a mansion. Standing alone in the middle of nowhere, it felt stubborn, like something that had resisted time for as long as it could and was only now surrendering. Rebecca sat behind a small desk, a large and solemn woman perched on a wooden chair that looked overly optimistic for the weight it was bearing. Name? Peter Brightley. You're the last to arrive, she handed him a paddle. Number 13. How lucky. She ignored the joke. Ballrooms down the hall.
Ballroom?
That's what they called it. A ballroom for ghosts? He asked. She didn't smile. She looked past him as if someone were approaching, though he knew there wasn't anyone. He took his paddle and left. The room held 2 dozen chairs. 11 were empty. Peter took a seat near the end of the second row and glanced around, unsettled by how unfamiliar everyone was. He almost always recognized someone at these things. Hello? He said to the man beside him. The man nodded without looking. Derek slid the pocket doors closed, sealing them in. Peter realized he'd been sitting on the program and scolded himself, standing briefly to retrieve it. He skimmed it while the auction began. Delacorte family, long gone, contents liquidated by a great-grandson who either didn't want to be bothered with it anymore or was in need of some cash. Sparse details, no sentiment. The sale proceeded predictably. Furniture, paintings, nothing remarkable. Then a young man entered, wheeling a barrel on a cart. That's odd, Peter thought. Thank you, David, Derek said to the young man. David nodded, then stepped aside and waited. Returning to the bidders, Derek said, Mr. Benjamin Delacorte was an avid walker, a hiker by today's terms. Peter straightened. He was a hiker too, though most of them were more like long strolls with his fellow hiking club members. 12 walking sticks, Derek continued, handmade, offered to guests when they came here. Mr. Delacorte believed in the healing powers of exercise and always managed to persuade his visitors to accompany him. I'm sure he did, thought Peter. He was about to dismiss the sticks when one caught his eye. Twisted, multicolored, wrong in a way he couldn't explain. May we see them? Peter asked. Derek smiled.
You may, but no touching.
Peter got up and walked forward, stopping in front of the barrel. The wood on this particular stick spiraled in 2 shades of brown, threaded with a dull gold vein that looked intentional, unnatural. Did he make these himself? He asked. Derek shrugged. It's a mystery. Like everything else about this, Peter thought. Do we have to take all of them? That's why it's called a lot. 500, he said, returning to his seat. The bidding climbed higher than it ever should have. 600, 1,000, 1,500. 2,000, Peter blurted, waving his paddle. It was an insane price, unless that vein along the stick was real gold. Sold, said Derek, ending the bidding, to Lucky 13. It didn't seem like much of a joke now. David wheeled the cart away. You didn't buy 12 sticks, he told himself, knowing it was true. You bought one. One walking stick he had not been allowed to touch. $2,000 he couldn't afford to spend. If he'd had more sense, he wouldn't even be here. But the whole thing had been so intriguing. That's why you called your store Curious Collectibles, he thought. You're a curious man, Peter Brightley. And we know what happened to the cat. He shrugged off his vague unease and waited to collect his barrel of walking sticks,